Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening to the NOLA Drink Show, friends. I do appreciate it. As always, yeah, our last show for 2019. We're going to take a little break after this one for the holidays, and then we'll be back in 2020 with some new shows. Looking forward to some of that stuff. Probably some minor tweaks to the show. Nothing too major, I don't expect. And hopefully some surprises along the way. We're looking forward to another year of bringing you the NOLA Drink Show. And I do want to, again, thank everyone for the ongoing support. It really does mean a lot to us. We've been at this for a little while now. Where are we at? Like 2.5, 3 years, something along those lines. 2.5, I think. And it's an honor to bring you the show each and every week, minus a few breaks here and there like we have coming up. And there you go. Really, thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. Want to wish everyone happy holidays, of course, as well, since I won't be talking to you again, at least with new stuff, until after the new year. Have you been going out and checking out those holiday pop-ups here in New Orleans? They go on holiday cocktail pop-ups all over the place. Our good friends there at Cocktail Kingdom, Greg Bohm and them, have their Miracle Holiday pop-up, which goes, there's dozens, scores of bars around that do that around the country. There's two here in New Orleans, Longway Tavern and Barrel Proof, part of the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, and also another sort of a similar concept, under the auspices of Cocktail Kingdom as well, but a bit different. The tiki-infused version of the holiday pop-ups. Our good friends Jeff Beachbum Berry and his wife Aneen are putting that on at Latitude 29. It's called Sippin' Santa. We did the show on that with Jeff and Brad Smith, the GM and head bartender over there at Latitude, not too long ago. Go check that out. Some really great drinks. And actually, I wanted to give a little bit of a shout-out or a little promo to them, if you will, at Latitude 29. They are selling the mugs and different things, the glassware that you get the drinks in for an additional cost, of course, in the drink. But they're giving a portion of the proceeds to a nonprofit to help fight hunger. I apologize, don't have that in front of me right now, which nonprofit it is, but for a good cause. And so you can go in, enjoy a cocktail. They have these really cool, kitschy, holiday-themed tiki mugs and glasses and so on and so forth. And you can take one home with you and you're donating to a good cause, and then you have a really cool mug that you can put in whatever you want into it. So there you go. Go check them out at Latitude 29 if you're here in New Orleans. And Sippin' Santa can actually be found around the country and I think a few spots in Canada as well. So do check that out. Just I think you can just Google Sippin' Santa and you can find out where the bars are. Same with the Miracle Holiday pop-up or just go check out cocktailkingdom.com. They can tell you where to find some cool holiday pop-up stuff. But where I was going with this, it is all the rage, man. I was at Barrel Proof just the other night and man, it was hopping. They had a line outside. They actually had to hire people to work the door, check IDs and all that stuff, and it was crazy. Actually, I was kind of startled when I was about to walk in. The guy's like, "Hey, I need to see your ID." I'm like, "Wait, what? I'm at Barrel Proof. I'm always here." But anyway, yeah, go check it out. It's a lot of fun, and I think most of them go through the end of the month until the 31st, and then we're kind of back to normal. Got a really good show coming up for you here, friends, this week. Been looking to do this one for a little bit. A new exhibit opened up at the Historic New Orleans Collection, and it is called Crescent City Sport, Stories of Courage and Change. And it's all about, well, you guessed it, sports in New Orleans and its history. Kind of picks up right after the Civil War and takes us up to the current day. But the really cool thing is it's not just about sports themselves, the games themselves. It's actually also about inclusivity, aspects of the history, aspects of the economic impact, some of the political components to the sports as they're played here, things like how the Superdome came to be, some stuff, a lot of political intrigue with certain things. So it's a really, really interesting exhibit. And they it's a handful of stories across, I think it's 20 stories across about a dozen sports that they kind of use to tell this narrative with different themes based on, again, all kinds of different social issues and stuff like that. So we are going to be chatting with Mark Cave, who is an oral historian and senior curator there at the Historic New Orleans Collection. And he gave us a personal tour of the exhibit, and then we tape the show. It's really, really fascinating stuff. It's a really cool exhibit. Go visit the Historic New Orleans Collection, friends. This exhibit is at their facility on Royal Street, 520 Royal Street at the St. Ray Brulator House. It is free, and there's all kinds of cool stuff. They got cool music stuff. They got great things going on at the Historic New Orleans Collection. We're big fans, and they're very gracious to host us these days to do shows from time to time, and that's what we got coming up for you. So, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show, and then we are going to be back with Mark Cave talking about Crescent City Sports, stories of courage and change. And once again, everyone, happy holidays and happy New Year. We'll see you in 2020. Come on back.
Oh, I'm sitting here, la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh, it may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming.
Welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. This week, as always, I do appreciate it. As you know, very special show, and a show I've been looking forward to doing for a little while here. We're back visiting with our friends at the Historic New Orleans Collection. We're talking about a new exhibit called Crescent City Sport, Stories of Courage and Change, and I am pleased to be joined by the man responsible for the exhibit, in large part, oral historian and senior curator here at HNOC, Mark Cave. Mark, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, Mark. Thank you so much for making time. I really appreciate it. And we got here just a little while ago to the museum, and you gave us a little bit of a whirlwind tour just to kind of hit some of the highlights. But it's a really fascinating exhibit that you all have put together here. It's not just telling the stories of the sports teams themselves. We're talking about the role of sports in the local culture here in New Orleans, which I think is reflective in other places to be sure, but talking about the role of sports in society, in our culture, in numerous ways. And that was, if I'm not mistaken, that was really the motivation to use sports to tell a larger story. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think sports mirror what's going on in our community whenever it's going on. So, and it's something that I've worked here at the collection 25 years now. And when I first came, we didn't have much in the area of sports. I think historical societies and museums tended to see it as something ephemeral, maybe not important enough to save. But social history has been gaining popularity the past few decades, and our collecting has reflected that, where we've acquired the Sugar Bowl archive right after Katrina. I've done interviews with people like Dave Dixon, John Meekum Jr., and they've all donated material to our museum. And so we wanted to do this exhibition to showcase that material, and then also use sports to tell stories of change in our community from the Civil War to the present. And it's just a fun way to do that. You know, normally history is kind of dry. But in sports, you see people running and playing and laughing, that it's a great way to kind of tell these larger stories of inclusivity and economic progress in ways that I think are more appealing to people.
Well, let me ask you this question, Mark, and I don't want to digress too much, but I think when we talk about sort of the way history has classically been studied, why do you think we're sports, and I hate to use this term, but sort of poo-pooed? It is such a great reflection of culture. It is such a great reflection of society on numerous levels. And you mentioned the word ephemeral. Do you think it was just because it was something that was seen as a second-class consideration? We're not talking about politics or battles or even art. One could argue that the import of it, of course. But why do you think it took a backseat up until just the larger social history aspect became more in play as we study history and talk about it?
Well, I think preserving things has always been expensive, you know, creating a place to collect and then keep things for posterity. So cost is a factor. I think there may have been some snobbery involved. You know, I think, people that end up being museum curators generally aren't great athletes and may have had our softball team can attest to that. But, But I do think there's larger. I think it's just the popular historical methods where history in the past was usually written about. Hello. Oh, okay. That, you know, history was tend to be focused on, you know, military campaigns, political history, great men doing great things. And I think that's kind of the old school of history, where you have history written from the point of view of wealthy white men, essentially, and just very few perspectives. And I think the great part of oral history, which I love so much, is that you gather all sorts of perspectives and you kind of write history based on a multitude of voices. And so I think that's all part of the social history movement that's been going on for the past few decades. And our collecting has now reflected that. And the types of exhibits that we do, I think, reflect that as well.
I think that's a great point, Mark. And thank you for clarifying that. I think also when we talk about the Historic New Orleans Collection, which is not what we're here to do today, but exhibits and holdings that include things on food and drink, for example, the culinary history here is also, I think, very reflective of that. Well, let's do this. Let's start here in this first segment. The exhibit. Tell us just let's just do a little bit in general on the exhibit. So 20 stories.
Yeah, it was. You know, sports is a big topic, and you know, not easily made sense of. You know, the teams change, the popular sports change over the decades, and so there's no clear narrative over the past 150 years, but we wanted to show how sports can reflect or teach us about changes in our society over the past 150 years. And since the Civil War, you know, our community's been working on that grand project of moving towards an inclusive society. And sports really played a big role in that. You know, who you choose to play with is something very central to our lives. And I think sports is a great medium to tell that story. Then we also wanted to speak to the value of sports, both as an economic engine. And you see that in our tourist economy today. Just think how important this Sugar Bowl is, how important having a Super Bowl is, and the Saints. And so sports play a big role in the tourist economy of today. And we wanted to show how that was created over time.
Mm-hmm. Great. Why don't we take the first one that you were showing us? Because so we mentioned 20 stories, and I think it's broken down over about a dozen sports, some stories within those sports. And we were talking when you were first showing us around the exhibit of rowing.
Yeah.
And the significant role that rowing played in a post-Civil War New Orleans.
Yeah. And rowing was one of the most popular sports in the late 19th century. And oarsmen, as they were called, were some of the biggest athletes of that time. What we focused on in that first story were these large national rowing regattas that were held, and New Orleans held three of them here, but they were intended to get northern and southern white men working at something together or competing against each other in some way that wasn't shooting each other, trying to you know, heal the sectional divide in the country. And it played a big role in that. And there were three of those big regattas held here, as I said. And they actually built a grandstand that could seat 5,000 people out at West End to watch these regattas on Lake Pontchartrain. So it was a really big sport and important to New Orleans at that time. And you see now some of these rowing clubs are being reconstituted along Bayou St. John, and it's become a popular sport once again.
Mark, who were behind, so I'm assuming this is what we would call these days a club sport, right, in that sense. Who were some of the people behind the different clubs? And then the follow-on question being, you know, as you said, the effort to bring Northern and Southerners together, those who are recently in conflict, were those clubs kind of broken down on those lines? And then,
Well, you know, normally we associate today rowing as being kind of an elitist sport.
You think sort of Ivy League kind of consideration?
Yeah, but it wasn't that way at all in the late 19th century. You had, you know, local businesses like, you know, cotton mills and metal foundries that put together their own rowing clubs. and New Orleans Firemen had a number of rowing clubs, and they'd compete against each other. And then you had some, you know, fancier clubs as well, but they all competed against each other. And so it was very egalitarian for that time.
So more of like a, like, sorry to interrupt, but like what we would consider today, that would be the company softball team or the company bowling team.
Yeah, something like that. Got it. But, you know, it was what people did, and they got really interested in it. And there were larger national societies that were created that put on these large regattas. And but there were clubs similar to this in cities all over the country.
Great. And obviously, we have a lot of water here.
So it's a perfect place for rowing.
Place for it. Right. Uh-huh. Excellent. So let's talk about this, because we got about 3-4 minutes before we're going to take the first break. Let's talk about John Sullivan and boxing, because I think he looms large in that regard, literally and figuratively.
He was such a huge figure in the history of American sports, and it's hard to find a comparable. I guess the closest thing may be LeBron James, but even LeBron wasn't as large of a figure
maybe
as John
Michael Jordan kind of thing where it transcends.
He was literally more popular than the president and more internationally recognized than the president of the United States at the time. But he won his heavyweight crown down here in New Orleans. Well, it wasn't technically in New Orleans. Boxing was illegal in most states, but our region had the reputation of looking the other way when those laws were broken. And so it was really interesting how they did these clandestine boxing matches at the time, where all these people from all over the country would descend on New Orleans, and they'd be staying at the hotels. And then in the middle of the night, a train would be loaded with all the spectators, and they would jet off to rural Mississippi. And they'd let them out, and they'd have the boxing match, and then everyone would flee back to New Orleans before they were arrested. And so it was, I think, that clandestine nature of these fights was part of the attraction. But he won his first heavyweight championship here, and then he defended it again in 1889. And for that fight, he trained at the New Orleans Athletic Club.
Okay.
And he was doing interviews all the time. And he did a plaster cast of his arm, which we have on display as part of the exhibit, which is really cool. And then he tried to defend his title again in 1892, but lost to gentleman Jim Corbett.
Okay.
You know, he was enjoying his celebrity. He was pursuing an acting career at that time. He was drinking a lot of beer. And there was a New Orleans artist in the French Quarter who painted a portrait of him that we have in our exhibit on loan from the Ogden Museum of Art. But it's of his back turned. And I'm thinking he turned his back because he probably had a beer belly at that time. but he was like totally out of shape. And Corbett just demolished him in that. And he lost his heavyweight crown down here as well. But that fight in particular was one of the biggest sporting events in American history. And you can find that in other sources. Like, I was going through the Children's Bureau archive, and that's the Louisiana Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. And in their records from that time, they state that they were picking up all of these runaway kids all over the city that had jumped trains as far away as California so they could be here in the same town that the fight took place. So what Sullivan did was he made New Orleans this place or this center for important sporting events. And we've had that reputation ever since then.
So building that tradition of, as you were saying, the Super Bowls and things like that, even if we're talking about sports that aren't necessarily centered here, these championship events happen here.
Yeah, to talk about that development, you really have to begin with Sullivan.
That's really interesting. Well, let's do this, Mark. Let's take a little bit of a break on the show here, and we're going to come back and highlight a couple more of the stories, 2-3 more of the stories in the exhibit, and we're going to talk further about some issues of inclusion as it relates to gender and race, and we're going to touch on some economic stuff as well, friends. So, friends, we're going to take a break here on the Mobile Drink Show. Come on now. right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here. Thanks for listening in. We're here at the Historic New Orleans Collection, and we are chatting with oral historian and senior curator Mark Cave. And Mark is telling us about Crescent City Sport, Stories of Courage and Change, a very fine new exhibit. Mark, I believe it runs till March 20th or so?
March 8th.
Oh, March 8th. I got that wrong. Uh-huh. Okay. So you have some time to come see it, and we'll make sure that we tell you how to do that at the end of this next segment. But do visit the Historic New Orleans Collection, friends. If you're from here and you haven't been here, shame on you. Come and visit. If you're coming from out of the area, this is a great place to start to help you frame the understanding of what our culture is here. I always tell people, Mark, to come to HNOC before you go hit all these other places, because it will, in a place like New Orleans that can make no sense in a lot of ways, or be maddening and frustrating, and but yet greatly rewarding and beautiful in other senses, this is a great place for people to show up and kind of put a lens on things that might help you understand better what you're seeing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, great. So we're talking about the course, sports and its relationship to the city, and very interesting stuff. And we talked a little bit previously about rowing, and then about John L. Sullivan. And now let's do this one first, because we talk about sports as being something that can be very powerful when it relates to inclusivity, both as it relates to gender and to race. So maybe let's pick a couple of the stories or so that relate and tell the story of racial inclusion, which can be a very troubling subject and a troubling reality in this part of the world for certain.
Oh, I know, but it's probably the most important historical topic that we need to talk about in our exhibitions. Inclusivity is something that we wanted to stress throughout the exhibit. Early on, of course, it's a story of exclusion. African Americans weren't allowed to participate in most of the events. So the rowing chapter is almost entirely white men competing against each other. We tell the story of the New Orleans Lawn and Tennis Club. African Americans were excluded from that as well. We tell the story of John L. Sullivan, but he refused to fight black fighters. And so we included a little section on George Dixon within Sullivan's chapter. And he was a Canadian African-American fighter who was part of the Bill of Three fights during the Sullivan-Corbett fight. And he fought at the Olympic Club, which was a venue in the Bywater neighborhood that could seat 10,000 spectators, which was fascinating. But they brought the black fans into the Olympic Club through a separate entrance, and they had to leave through a separate entrance. But Dixon won his fight convincingly, and it was a huge event in New Orleans that there were celebrations in the African-American community all over the city. So that was one story. And so we try to pepper all of the stories with this underlying story of inclusion. And, then there's some main stories beginning in 1956 with the story of Bobby Grier, who was the first African-American to play in the Sugar Bowl, which was a huge deal. And the Sugar Bowl committee selected Pittsburgh and Georgia Tech as the teams to play because it was the best matchup. But the governor of Georgia demanded that Georgia Tech pull out of the game because University of Pittsburgh had this black player on their team named Bobby Grier. And we got to interview Bobby for this exhibit, and he was just very mild-mannered, and he told his teammates that he didn't want to jeopardize their future, so he would stay home. But they all rallied behind him and said they wouldn't play unless he played. And a Georgia Tech team voted, and they said they wanted to play despite what their governor said. But it was a huge story in the early civil rights movement in 1956. And there were protests and things going on campuses all over. But he came to the Sugar Bowl, and unfortunately, Georgia Tech won the game. But he's such an interesting character, and he talked about how he wasn't allowed technically into the St. Charles Hotel for the banquet for the game, but he said he just walked in with his teammates anyway, and the Georgia Tech players invited him to have dinner with them. And so you see athletics as being a little ahead of the game. Mm-hmm. You know, they admired somebody's skill, not the color of their skin. And so you see this even today where African-American players are kind of pushing the envelope on social change. And you see that with Colin Kaepernick. You see it with other stars as well. But that goes back to Bobby Grier's time. So it's a story we've been retelling over and over again. Then in 1965, you have the story of the AFL All-Star Game, which was being put on by local organizers as part of the attempt to land an NFL franchise or a professional
football. So American Football League, so people know it's merged with the NFL, just so people know what we're talking
about.
So
they were both professional leagues. And so it was a big deal. It was a big national event to have the AFL All-Star Game here in New Orleans. But when the players arrived at the airport, it was just after the Civil Rights Bill had passed. And taxi drivers wouldn't pick up the players at the airport. Some of the black players couldn't get into clubs and bars. And so they voted to boycott the game and pulled out. And the game was ultimately played in Houston. But it was a big black eye for the community and hurt our chances for years of getting a pro football franchise.
Very interesting. So I don't want to talk too much about this. We got 3-4 minutes before we take another break here, Mark. But with baseball, because I think people don't, beyond the college level, people don't necessarily associate baseball too much with this part of the world. But it has a rich history of both Negro League baseball as well as the barnstorming tradition, which I think kind of merged across some racial lines at times too, didn't it?
I had a hard time of telling that story because we have the real interesting story of the New Orleans Pelicans, which was a segregated white team, and it was very interesting. And then you had the Negro Southern League and the city's representative in that league, and then you had all of the smaller Negro League teams. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting.
Louis Armstrong had a team, the Secret Nine.
Right? He had the Secret Nine, and they weren't a very talented team, but he funded them well, and so they had the best uniforms. But the other Negro league teams would make fun of them. So it was a very colorful time, and there were some Negro League owners like Alan Page, who was very much ahead of his time, and he incorporated women into his team as well. Players like Tony Stone, who were actually very good players, and he included women coaches as well. And so you see a very progressive element within the Negro Leagues as well, but it was very much segregated, up and through the 60s. So.
Okay, got it. I'm always curious about that. I think what we'll have to do, Mark, is we'll have to get together and do a future show and talk about baseball specifically.
Yeah.
Because I'm biased. I'm a big fan of baseball. But I know in certain other parts of the country, for example, that when these barnstorming tours, and what those are, friends, is when players, like major league players, when they weren't playing the major league season, would travel around and play these exhibition games, that sometimes you would actually have, games against white players against African-American teams and things like that, which we obviously didn't see in the major leagues until, of course, Jackie Robinson. But so great. Well, we got a couple minutes left. So go. Were you going to say something? Please.
I was going to talk. People don't realize, but integration had a big deal to do with the New Orleans getting a professional football franchise. Mayor Morrison, at the time, the Pelicans baseball team left in 1960. And of course, that was politically damaging to Mayor Morrison, who had aspirations of being governor. And so he had dreams initially of creating a state-of-the-art baseball stadium in the lakefront to attract a Major League Baseball team. But Dave Dixon, who was a local promoter, called him and said, "We've got Tulane Stadium here. It's one of the best football stadiums in the country. We should go after a pro football franchise." And so Morrison agreed and put Dixon ahead of this committee to find an NFL franchise or an AFL franchise. But the problem at the start was racial integration. You couldn't have integrated seating here in New Orleans. And so they had to work around that issue when they were trying to lobby for a professional football team here. And so they wanted to prove to the NFL that New Orleans was capable of hosting an integrated event. And so they hosted these series of preseason games at Tulane Stadium.
Okay.
And Tulane Stadium was critical because it was on private property. And so they couldn't ignore the race laws at the time. But to get permission to use Tulane Stadium, Dave Dixon very cleverly invited the Detroit Lions to play in one of these exhibition games. And the Lions were owned by William Ford, who also controlled the Ford Foundation, right, which donated a lot of money to American universities. So Dixon had William Ford write a letter to Tulane asking for permission to use Tulane Stadium. And of course, they couldn't say no to William Ford. And so they were able to host these preseason games at Tulane Stadium with an integrated audience, which was a big achievement during the segregated South.
Absolutely. Mark, let's do this. Take a little break here on the show. I'm going to come back and talk a little bit more about Crescent City Sport, stories of courage and change. Come on back.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans.
Everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. I do appreciate it. As always, a really fascinating conversation we're having here at the Historic New Orleans Collection, gracious enough to host us again. We did a show recently here with Dr. Jessica Harris not too long ago, which was fascinating. I encourage you to go back and go to visit our website and check out that show on foodways and the influence of the African diaspora on how we eat. But we're talking about Crescent City sports stories of courage and change, and we are here with oral historian and senior curator Mark Cave, as you know. And Mark, we're talking about various aspects of the 20 stories that you selected to tell the story of sports in the area and how it relates to us socially, which is the most important underpinning or theme of the exhibit. And we talked a little bit about some different things, but let's talk a little bit about gender inclusion here, because I think we have a couple great stories that tell that.
It was an interesting aspect of this show, and one that took a lot of work to find images. So in each section, we tried to incorporate women's sports in some way. In the oarsmen, we talk a little bit how women didn't participate in the rowing regattas to the extent that we know, but they had an interest in rowing, and we found some images of them rowing as a pastime. But the first big story about women in sports in New Orleans dealt with the New Orleans Lawn and Tennis Club, which is the oldest lawn and tennis club in the country. And that's because there were a lot of British nationals living in New Orleans who were involved in the cotton trade. And the rules for tennis had just been codified in England in the 1870s, and they started playing tennis here early on.
Was this about that time in the 1870s?
Yeah, okay. 1876, I think the club was founded.
Okay.
Women had an interest in tennis from the start. You know, they just were very enthusiastic about the sport, and they were able to force the integration of the New Orleans Lawn Tennis Club as early as 1890, which was very progressive for that time. Another story where we incorporate women in sports is in a story called Inventing the Wheel, and that's about the bicycle clubs in 19th century New Orleans, which, you know, you think of bicycle racing and everything, but it was much more than that. It was like a social movement, like the invention of the bicycle all of a sudden gave people this freedom to explore, you know, extend beyond the city limits. They weren't dependent on transportation by horse and buggy. And it was a very liberating event, and it was liberating for women as well. They formed these clubs, and they'd have excursions. They'd ride their bikes out to Bay St. Louis or up to the North Shore, and they just seemed to have such a great time. And that's part of this exhibit that I really love, is that you see people enjoying life, which you don't see in many history exhibits. And so, the bicycle changed women's fashions in a big way. Like all of a sudden they were out and they could explore the city on their own. And they created what's called the drop-down safety bicycle. And that's similar to the bike we have today with the top bar removed. Mm-hmm. But that was to accommodate women's fashions of the time and to allow them to mount a bicycle and ride. So it had an influence on the early feminist movement and changing their cumbersome clothing and getting them outside and participating in athletic activity. The next story that we have really focused on women's sports is the story of the New Orleans Pride, which was the New Orleans representative in the first women's basketball league, professional basketball league. And it was such a fascinating story. The New Orleans team owners were very protective of the players. Like, it was very different than it is today, where the team owner hired hairdressers and makeup people to work on the players' hair and makeup before each game so they looked like ladies and everything. And it was kind of a, you know, odd look on sports that you wouldn't see today. And we show that by featuring the New Orleans Roller Girls, the Big Easy Roller Girls, in another section or another story, just to show how much women's sports have changed just since the late 70s to the present.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So with the New Orleans Pride, what was the league, the first women's basketball
league? Was the WBL, Women's Basketball League. And New Orleans had a pretty successful franchise in it. The league was banking on, however, getting kind of a media push from covering the women's basketball at the 1980 Olympics, which was to be held in Moscow. Mm-hmm. But we pulled out of the Olympics, and so the league never got that sort of media bump that they were hoping for, and the league folded soon after that.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. We got about 3 minutes, Mark, before I want to have people tell, or you tell people where to visit the exhibit that are listening on the radio. Tell us a little bit, just briefly, about the Pelican as what it is symbolic of. We'll talk about the franchise in the podcast, only thing, the basketball franchise, but tell us why it's so important as a sports icon here. Yeah.
Well, one of the stories we focus on in the exhibit comes from Tom Benson's oral history, and he talked about how during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, he and some of the Saints players went down to Fort Jackson, where they were rescuing pelicans from the oil. And he was very moved by that experience, that he said that if he ever had a chance to rename a New Orleans sports franchise, he'd call them the Pelicans. And so he did. He rebranded the Hornets, the Pelicans. And it really fits the identity of our community. The pelican symbol goes way back, particularly the pelican in Piety, where she's sort of pecking at her own breast to feed her young, her own blood. That's a ancient sort of European medieval symbol that was adopted by a lot of the Masonic lodges. Mm-hmm. And the first Masonic lodge here in New Orleans had that as one of their symbols. And they were involved in the creation of state government. It was eventually placed on the state flag and became a real potent symbol for regional identity.
So everybody listening outside the area that don't understand why our NBA team is called the Pelicans, now you know. So there you go. Well, Mark, do me a favor. We got about a minute and a half left before I got to close out the radio portion of the show. Would you tell people where they can find the exhibit, find HNOC, mm-hmm. and online and on the street, as I like to say?
Well, the exhibit is at our new exhibition center, which is at 520 Royal Street. It's in the old Brulator building with the famous courtyard. It's really a beautiful renovation that we've done there. And it was also where WDSU was located for years. Mm-hmm. But we've renovated the old building, and then we've built an addition onto the back of it, which is a state-of-the-art museum facility. And the sports exhibit, Crescent City Sports, Courage of Swords and Change, is there till November or till March 8th.
March 8th. It's a free admission to the museum in its entirety, right?
Yeah.
What's the website for Historic New Orleans Collection?
HNOC.org.
HNOC.org. And friends, we do encourage you again to visit HNOC when you're here, if you're visiting, or if you live here and you haven't been, or there's always things changing, so be sure to come check it out. It's an important organization that tells so many important stories about our city and our region, so it's a don't miss destination for you, whether you're local or coming from abroad. Mark is going to stick around for our podcast only segment, Another Shot with Nola Drinks. I think we're going to get a little bit into the Saints, believe it or not. We held it for that. And I'm going to talk about the Superdome and its development and a couple other things. So Mark, thanks for being here on this portion. If you are listening to the radio, friends, go to noladrinks.com. You can get the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and hear our ongoing conversation that we're about to do. But if you are listening on the radio, friends, remember, be kind to one another, use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all.
All right, everybody, yep, another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it. As always, really interesting conversation we're having here with Mark Cave of the Historic New Orleans Collection. I thank him for his time and giving us a personal tour of the exhibit before we tape the interview. I do highly encourage everybody to go check out the exhibit if you are here in New Orleans or if you're planning a visit before March 8th. Do stop by and see it. We're going to bounce right back over to HNOC and continue our conversation with Mark. Here we go. Yep, another shot with Nola Drinks. Friends, Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the show this week. As always, we are chatting with Mark Cave, who is an oral historian and senior curator here at the Historic New Orleans Collection, a very fine institution here, located kind of, Mark, peppered throughout the French Quarter is a fair way to say it, right? We were talking about the 520 Rural Street at the St. Ray Brulator House, where the sports exhibit is, but the original HQ was, or the original exhibit space was right across the street. Mm-hmm. And then we're actually sitting in your office, which is the research facility where a lot of the holdings are on Charter Street. And the footprint of this space is actually rather large.
Yeah, it's getting bigger every time. We're taking over the quarter.
That's good. We don't need another Willie's Chicken Shack. No. I'd rather see more HNOC than more Willie's Chicken Shack. That is a topic for another show, friends. But we're chatting about the really fine exhibit that you're behind, Mark, Crescent City Sport, Stories of Courage and Change, and really fascinating stuff. And I kind of wanted to go, as I was telling you before, for some of the things that in the radio portion of the first three segments that people wouldn't necessarily know. And I didn't want to assume that we're just going to jump right into the New Orleans Saints.
Yeah.
But now that we're doing the podcast, the only thing, let's jump into the New Orleans Saints. And we were talking just here during the break a little bit about how it's so interesting. I mean, this is from my own perspective, how it's so interesting the way the Saints cut across so many cultural, demographic, racial lines, economic lines in the city. And I think it's really unique, at least in this country, of how many different walks of life associate with the Saints. And we were discussing the idea that that is really probably largely in function of a post-Katrina world reality.
Yeah, I think in that DNA of an athlete, you want to be a champion. And I think that really came out with the Saints post-Katrina, where they became champions of the city. You know, they were such a big part of our recovery. And so you saw the whole community come together in support of the Saints from that period, from 2006, watching Gleason block that punt, to 2010 when they won the Super Bowl. The Saints were the champions of our city during that really difficult time. And it brought all the elements of our community together in support of one team. And I don't think you see that in other cities.
I certainly don't think you do. And I think, and it was so important, Mark, if I'm not mistaken, too, when, you know, the Saints came back and it played as quickly as they possibly could. And it created a venue, it created a destination, it created an image or an iconography that people could go relate around, right?
Yeah, it T-shirts and, you know, community gatherings for each game. It was a very important part of our society during that time. And it really, you know, shows how the value of sports to a community, particularly in times of crisis.
Yeah, that's a really great way to put it. And I think it also allowed folks that had left the area due to Katrina to find something to rally around. You could go to the sports bar in Houston, go to the sports bar in Nashville and watch the Saints games and connect with people who were in your shoes.
Yeah. It's a very important time.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the development of the Superdome, because it has a fascinating economic story and just a urban development story as well.
Well, I talked in an earlier segment about those preseason games that Dixon and his committee organized to prove that New Orleans could host an integrated event. But at one of those preseason games, there was this torrential rainstorm, and it caused all the fans to go underneath the stands at Tulane Stadium. And the committee was worried that there would be some sort of race riot that would break out under the stands. And thankfully, nothing happened. But they thought of the idea of the Superdome at that time, and it sort of became part of New Orleans' bid for a pro football franchise, that they would construct this new Superdome. But they didn't really have any funding to do that. And so Dave Dixon hired a conceptual artist to do an early rendering of what he thought the Superdome would look like. And Dave Dixon was playing around with ideas for names. And he thought of first the Ultradome, calling it the Ultradome.
Oh, wow. I didn't
but,
know that.
Okay. But instead, he thankfully chose Superdome, which sounds much better. But then he just went to Governor McKithen at that time, which was a pretty bold move to all of a sudden, let's, you know, go to Governor McKithen and ask him for millions of dollars to build a stadium. But McKithen loved the idea. The Astrodome had just been built in Houston. And I think at that time, probably because of the oil industry, there was kind of a competition between Louisiana and Texas. And McKithen wanted to build something bigger and better than Texas, something that you could fit the Astrodome inside of. And so that's what they did. So they came up with a plan for a dome stadium that could fit the Astrodome inside of it. And so they got it. And, you know, the whole project was politicized from the start. They had to go to the polls to get a bond issue passed to raise money. And so you had opposition from the very start regarding the dome. But, you know, it's proved to be a very a good project. And in the exhibit, we have some early drawings, like Dixon and other people were going touting the multi-use nature of the Superdome plan. And so they had early images of Mardi Gras parades being held in the dome, which they ultimately did do. They had a St. Patrick's Day parade in the dome, which I don't think they've done that yet. But they were trying to sell this idea of a Superdome. So it was a big project. In the exhibit, we have interviews with Buster Curtis, who is the architect of the dome, talking about it. So it's very, very interesting section of the exhibit. We have the shovel from the groundbreaking ceremony at the dome.
Oh, wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it took a lot of political finagling then for the dome to be built, right?
And
it did. And it was modeled, as you were saying, on the idea that we're not just going to do this for a football franchise. We're going to do this for a multi-use.
Yeah. There's one story. Jimmy Fitzmaurice was tasked with acquiring the land from the railroads to place the Superdome on it. And that wasn't an easy task. The railroad didn't necessarily want to sell the land, but he told them that if he was governor, he would make life very difficult for them if they didn't sell the land to the state. And so kind of a veiled threat. Fitzmaurice wasn't governor at the time, but he was just thinking, you know,
if he was setting up a quid pro quo.
Yeah, I know. You better cooperate with the state. And so it was very typical Louisiana politics at the time.
Right, exactly. It makes all the sense in the world, friends. That's really interesting. I had no idea that that was the case either. Okay. Mm-hmm. What about... since we were talking about football here a little bit, just we talked about the AFL, of course, the league that merged with the NFL to form the larger NFL. What about the USFL? That has a very interesting connection to the city as well.
Yeah, that was actually the concept of the USFL was created by Dave Dixon as part of his effort to get the Saints. You know, he was trying to leverage the NFL into awarding New Orleans a franchise. So he came up with this idea of a rival league. And, you know, he's saying to Roselle, if you don't give us a team, we'll create this separate league. And it never happened. The Saints were awarded to the city in 1967, and the plans for the USFL were abandoned until the emergence of cable television in the late 70s. And so after Dixon had threatened that possibility, the NFL locked up the third television network with Monday Night Football. Like, they had NBC
and CBS
already locked in with contracts with the NFL. And so they created Monday Night Football to lock up that third media outlet to sort of ward off any potential competitive league from forming. But the cable television changed that dynamic entirely and offered a window for a rival league to happen. And so the Dixons realized this. And so from their offices on Charter Street, they began creating the USFL and recruited really well-funded owners such as Donald Trump, who owned the New Jersey Generals, and Leon Canizzaro here in town owned the New Orleans Breakers. Mm-hmm. And there were people like Burt Reynolds, who owned a portion of the Tampa Bay Bandits.
Right,
and
right.
So it's a fascinating league and has really been a popular topic for research in recent years because of Trump's involvement in the league.
Yeah, absolutely. And that part, of course, being relevant. And then also aspects, too, of attempts, future or current and recent past attempts at alternative football leagues, which have all failed miserably. I mean, the AFL was arguably a success story.
Yeah.
It was emerged with the NFL, and the USFL didn't last particularly long, but a lot of players ended up in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything that we've seen since then, the one or two attempts since then have not really worked, and now they're apparently trying again.
Yeah.
We'll see how that happens.
I got to interview Dave Dixon back in 2009, okay. Year before he passed away, and he was such a sweet man. But he was even then, at his age, working on a potential rival league to the NFL, and it was a community-owned football league where the communities would own their own teams and everything. So he was still working till the year before his death on ideas, football ideas.
Wow, very interesting. Following that Green Bay Packers model, I guess, something along those lines. Well, Mark, do me a favor. Tell people, we're going to close out the podcast portion of the interview here. Tell people where they can once again find the exhibit, find the museum itself, and then online and on Royal Street.
Well, we're located in the French Quarter, 520 Royal Street. We have a number of buildings, but that's our exhibition center. And it's a newly renovated historic building. It used to be the home of WDSU, and is the beautiful Brulatour Courtyard is there. And then in the back of it, we've built a state-of-the-art museum facility where we have changing exhibitions and larger exhibitions like the sports show are shown there.
Mm-hmm. Great. A lot of great stuff. Music stuff.
Yeah.
All kinds. And you guys have such a large collection that you're able to, you're constantly rotating things through, correct?
Yeah. This has been a long time coming. We've been around since the 60s, and we've been aggressively collecting on the history of New Orleans, history and culture of New Orleans. But we've never had the space to really show the things we've collected. And now we do. So we're very excited about the opportunity to create these exhibitions that help define who we are as a people.
That's really important. And friends, again, I did say this before, if you're in the area, please come visit the Historic New Orleans Collection. It's always changing. If you haven't been here, you need to come here. It will tell you a lot about where you live. And if you are coming to visit, it's a great place to start your visit because it will help shed so much light on this area and help you understand a place that I always like to say is maddening, frustrating, yet rewarding and beautiful at the same time. And it's a great way to really help you through it. Mark, I really appreciate your time and I look forward to doing this again.
Oh, good. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Friends, that was Mark Cave, oral historian and senior curator here at the Historic New Orleans Collection. We'll take a brief musical interlude and I'll be back with my parting shot.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it as always. Hope you enjoyed that conversation there with Mark Cave at the Historic New Orleans Collection. Very, very interesting exhibit. I encourage you to pay it a visit. It closes March 8th. So if you live here, go check it out. If you're coming for a visit, go check it out. And as we have said repeatedly, if you are coming to visit New Orleans, make sure that the Historic New Orleans Collection is a stop on your itinerary. It is a great place to come and learn about our city and our region, and I think it will make your visit far more understandable and enjoyable. You'll just understand and comprehend so much more of what you're seeing around town and around the region if you go pay them a visit right out of the gate. Friends, this is our parting shot. Pretty short one here. Just want to wish everybody happy holidays, a happy new year. Looking forward to 2020. Want to thank you for all the support you've given the NOLA Drink Show. We're coming up on, I guess we'll have our 3-year anniversary fairly soon, if I'm not mistaken. It's a joy and a privilege to bring it to you almost each and every week. We're taking the next 3 weeks off for the holidays. We'll be back on January 13th with a new show. So I do hope that everyone has a joyous, hopeful, peaceful holiday season. I hope for all of us in 2020, we have a better world, a world that is built on justice, inclusivity, environmental responsibility, equality, proper education, safety, respect. That's my wish for you. That's my wish for yours and for everybody here in the New Orleans area, for everybody in the United States, and for everybody on planet Earth. Happy holidays, everybody. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.